Joe, again, it's my great pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for that introduction. That's kind of hard to live up to, but I'll try.
Okay. All right. Well, it's totally true. So, you know, Joe, you were the one who suggested that we talk about Aphorism 153, and you had mentioned using a Buddhist or Talmudic approach to its study. And so I thought, you know, what you really want to do here is just kind of take apart the whole aphorism in the Organon and really kind of explain your understanding of it, or at least have a dialogue about how we can best understand it and use it in practice. So I thought I would start off by asking you, because I know there's different translations of the Organon, if there's a particular translation that you prefer that you'd like to use this evening, and what is your thinking on the different translations, and what would be most appropriate for the students to use in their own studies and practice?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, I think it was even Wenda Brewster O'Reilly herself, I think, in an interview that said that, you know, translations are a reflection also of the translator. There's no such thing as a pure and totally accurate translation. We need many translations of the Organon from many different sources, many different people, and we need for very erudite scholars to be arguing about what means what from what perspective. From my perspective as a student, I truly enjoy the Kunsley version. I find the language direct, understandable, and to the point. After all, although the Organon is an extremely erudite piece of literature with multiple levels of meaning, its first and foremost role is as a how-to book, a guide for dummies. And Hahnemann begins by explaining what a system of medicine should be, and at the very beginning he says that any system of medicine must be drawn up according to clear and comprehensible principles. Now, well, we all pay lip service to that, but what does comprehensible mean? Comprehensible to me means, as a student, I should be able to clearly understand what it is you're pointing at that I do. Now, it might take me years to get there, but I have to be able to clearly see and clearly know that with some degree of practice and reasonable time, I should be able to do what you do. And the language in that Kunsley edition, to me, is very clear, very comprehensible. When we go to, I love Wenda Brewster O'Reilly's version as well, especially for the glossary, and for the margin notes and the division of the book into sections. But I'm also concerned about the fact that Stephen Decker, as a Goethean scholar, are we getting a translation that's too philosophical, perhaps even metaphysical, in some of its ways? Whereas I prefer something that's more down to earth, maybe even a bit more on the medical practical side.
You know, I'll tell you, I've always felt that the different translations, that the Kunsley was the most readable one. I know one of the drawbacks is it doesn't have an introduction. How do you address that, or do you feel that that's important?
The introduction to the Organon is extremely important. It gives Hahnemann's raison d'etre. It talks about the need. In fact, there is Sarkar's book, The Organon, which is a wonderful exposition of the philosophy and history of medicine salient to homeopathy, and even has a wonderful comparison of the different aphorisms in the different editions at the back, along with the introduction. All of this is important. Mm-hmm. You know, this is our basic tool. We should know it.
So could you, for the benefit of the people listening, could you spell the author's last name, so if they're interested in that book you just mentioned, that they could look it up or acquire?
Yes, Sarkar, Dr. Sarkar, S-A-R-K-A-R, in the 50s, wrote a book called The Organon. It might be the outline of The Organon, I'm not sure. But essentially, the initial part of the book talks about salient scientific and medical history and philosophy up to the time of Hahnemann, and including the time of Hahnemann. It then goes into a presentation of the sixth edition of the Organon. And afterwards, it talks about a comparison between the aphorisms in all the different editions and how they changed, with, in the appendix, many different articles, and all of them salient to the study of the Organon. A wonderful book.
Okay, well, listen, I don't want to go over this point too much, but just one more quick question. I know there's also a Berkey Dudgeon translation, And I had a while back heard Julian Winston make the comment that he likes to take at least two of the different versions, translations of the Organon. He likes to actually put them side by side, and when he's reading them, compare the two different versions, or in this case, maybe even three different versions. What do you think about that?
I think it's a wonderful exercise, and you know, I've had the opportunity to do it, and I'll even go one step further, Kim,
okay,
which is wonderful, and that is that if in the audience there is somebody with a scientific background and who is a native German speaker, it becomes even more wonderful.
Mm.
And add to that, if that native German speaker has a German version of the Organon, then it becomes even more fun in trying to banter out what exactly is this word and what is the gist of it, what are we trying to say here. It's a riot.
Mm. Okay, great. So, Joe, how do you suggest we proceed here? I know you want to literally take apart aphorism 153 and really investigate it really deeply. Would you suggest that we read it? And then, if so, which translation would you like to do that from?
I'm going to do it from Wendell Brewster O'Reilly's version, because I think most people have that version.
Okay, good.
And I want to do a little bit of an introduction.
Okay.
When we do this. Now, the reason for doing this is because as a student, and I believe all students do this, I defy you to tell me differently, the Organon is perhaps the world's greatest cure for insomnia. There is no doubt that after reading the introduction, if you are sufficiently brave and have the endurance to survive the introduction, I mean, the first few aphorisms, you're toast. You'll be asleep. Your concentration is gone. It is hard. It is difficult reading these long, long sentences with one phrase referring to something a couple of phrases before, the footnotes. I found that when I began to teach the Organon some, 8 years ago orally, we actually had a class where we went through aphorism by aphorism orally. And I was challenged at each point by a group of very eager, intelligent students in their first year of homeopathic study. My God, I never learned more about the Organon than I did having to prepare for that class and facing them in a sweat. And when you do it orally, I believe the Organon is meant to be studied orally, aphorism by aphorism, and studied in a way that hits the road for practitioners now. This is a how-to manual. And historically, the greatest downfall of homeopathy came about when it lost its roots, when it lost its origins in the Organon. There were, what, some 15,000 practitioners in the U.S. at the peak of homeopathy and only 300 copies of the Organon? And today, when we study it, how many of us actually just study it from Kent's lectures on philosophy or read it just to get it done and over with, and then we get on with the real stuff? We need to really dig into this book, really understand it. So when we study it, I do want to do it in almost the Talmudic tradition where two scholars wanting to understand something about the scriptures will talk back and forth, and there'd be no better partner than you, Kim, with your enormous knowledge base and your wonderful intellect.
Well, thanks, Joe.
So, yeah, let's go through this.
Okay, sounds good. Well, do you want to start reading the first part, or how would you like to do it?
Well, why don't we? Let me just read it.
If you want me to read it, I'm happy to. It's whatever you'd like.
No, I'll read it. Let's do it. And then we can just stop as we wish.
Okay, that sounds good.
And then we'll talk. So, 153. In the search for a homeopathically specific remedy, that is, in the comparison of the complex of the natural disease's signs with the symptom sets of the available medicines, in order to find among them an artificial disease potence that corresponds in similarity to the malady to be cured, the more striking, exceptional, unusual, and odd or characteristic signs and symptoms of the disease case, are to be especially and almost solely kept in view. These above all must correspond to very similar ones in the symptom set of the medicine sought if it is to be the most fitting one for cure. The more common and indeterminate symptoms, lack of appetite, headache, lassitude, restless sleep, discomfort, are to be seen with almost every disease and medicine, and thus deserve little attention unless they are more closely characterized. All right, let's go back. It's a huge thing. You know, Hahnemann, as always, condenses into an aphorism an entire course. It's amazing. So in the search for a homeopathically specific remedy, that's a wonderful thing. Why that terminology, homeopathically specific remedy? Why use the word specific remedy? What do you think?
Well, I assume it's because this is going to be individualized for that specific case.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, the other reason, of course, being that at the time of Hahnemann, the holy grail of conventional medicine was the specific.
Hmm.
The people sought the specific for this plague, for that epidemic. So the concept of the specific was the holy grail in medicine. And here we are saying that Hahnemann says, yes, I'm looking for a specific too, but the specific relates not to the definition of this diagnostic category, but rather relates to the definition of the individual disease this person is suffering from.
Sure.
So he's using homeopathically specific remedy.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, in the comparison of the complex of natural disease signs with the symptom sets of available medicines. So why that? Why did he say the complex of natural disease signs with the symptom sets of available medicines?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's going on here is that Hahnemann doesn't look at the symptoms as a list, but literally a relationship or a complex or a pattern of information which has to be discovered first in the patient and then correspond that to similar symptoms in the remedies that we seek, again, in complex or patterns of relationship.
Absolutely true. You're way ahead of me here. But then why symptom sets and a complex of natural disease signs and then symptom sets of available medicines?
Sure. Well, of course, I mean, I think I'll let you answer it rather than me answer, but I think that there's two things. One is that, again, these symptoms are in relationship to each other, so there's sets of them, but also we have a limited number of remedies, and so therefore we're going to have to find our answer in what's available to us.
Right. So not only what's available to us, but what's available to us that has been thoroughly proven.
Sure.
And the symptom sets, meaning that we have a rock solid basis right here.
Mm, sure.
That's the feel of that. Now, comparison of the complex of the natural diseases signs. That's a wonderful way of translating it. It's a wonderful, I don't know if that's the case in the Kundli, but I love that particular terminology.
Mm.
The complex, meaning that not only do we have a group of symptoms, a set of symptoms from the patient, but that there can be an infinite number of relationships which occur between the set of symptoms we ascertain inductively from the patient through case taking. And that it's up to us to see the relationship as it is depicted in the symptom set from the available provings.
Mm-hmm.
More or less, just as you said, just with a slight twist.
Sure. Joe, you used the word inductive, and I was hoping that for those people on the call who may not be familiar with that terminology, if you could just quickly translate that for them, and maybe just give a little bit of a background as how and why that's important for our current discussion.
Oh, that's a great conversation. We had this one ourselves, and you taught me quite a few things there. But, yes, so Hahnemann says in the introduction, in several... actually, in the introduction, I think, to the fourth and the fifth edition of the Organon, he said, if we take one step outside the purely inductive method, we'll be forever lost. So what's that mean? Hahnemann in the Medical Observer, a wonderful article, talks about the fact that it's rare to find amongst physicians somebody who's an impartial observer. It's rare to find somebody who's taken the time and the trouble to be able to look at something impartially, to gather information from a place of having no particular axe to grind, from a place of only being interested in judging what is it I am perceiving. And if I am perceiving it, how can I question it so as to be sure that I'm really perceiving this and not something I simply wish to believe because I come to the table with a set of beliefs. So inductive here means gathering information as purely as possible without prejudice, questioning it vigorously so as to ensure that what you're actually getting from the patient is precisely it. A wonderful example. I had a preceptor in the other day, and a gentleman was saying to me, I always have this particular sciatic pain in the leg at night. So then you say to yourself, okay, how can I question this? How can I rattle this to see what shakes loose? So then when we asked him, when at night? Well, he said, when I'm in bed. Well, does it happen before you lie down? No, only when I lie down. So it's now at night, lying in bed. Well, what happens if you were to lie down during the day? Well, let me think. As it turns out, he'd had a nap, and yes, immediately upon lying down at any time, the pain would occur. Then we check, well, what about position? Well, we find not only is it lying down any time, but it was lying on the left side with the knee bent. And then pursuant to that, we found out that, you know what, it got better even in that position when he would stretch his leg out. So we had a very peculiar symptom that we arrived at by continually knocking the symptom. And the symptom there was that we had a sciatica that was ameliorated stretching the leg out. Now, if you know the orthopedic testing for sciatica, you'll know that stretching the leg out vigorously will usually irritate the sciatic nerve. So that becomes a strange, rare, and peculiar. And originally, prima facie, that particular symptom was pain worse at night. And it just morphed as we questioned it. That's the inductive gathering of information. Trying to question so as to be sure that what you are seeing is what actually is, with as little presupposition as possible, as little belief as possible. You know, if you come to the table thinking, hey, I'm going to practice homeopathy, I'm coming here, I'm going to find the real essence of this case. By simply holding that in mind, Hahnemann would say, having that belief entering the room, you are no longer practicing homeopathy. By believing, hey, I'm going to find this person's theme, central delusion, whatever, by having that in mind, you are limiting your flexibility. You are no longer practicing inductively. You are practicing through a deduction, that is, a filter through which you think, and therefore not practicing homeopathy. Does that help?
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more, and I just love the way that you described that because, I mean, to me, I think this is a real central reason that people are not getting better success in their practice, that they're not really looking to see really what is the symptom of the patient as opposed to some abstraction in their mind or some idea that they've come to before taking the case. And, I want to applaud you for stating that so eloquently because I really think it's a key, actually, to being able to help our patients.
You know, Kim, there is no more frightening thing, I believe, than being a homeopathic student and saying to yourself, what the heck am I going to do here? And it speaks to the need for mentoring. It speaks to the need for education in Hahnemannian principles. You know, George von Keller wrote a wonderful article called Homeopathy Simplified in the Classical Homeopathic Quarterly. And in that article, he states that ever since the beginning of homeopathy, it has been so daunting as a field of endeavor that there have been books from 1838 on trying to simplify homeopathy into a little particular system.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, people have been flocking to teachers who could do that for them, who could say, okay, I'm going to make it easier for you. This is what you do. This is how you boil it down. But you know, Kim, the beauty of homeopathy, and the more I practice it, the more I understand it, is that in homeopathy, in seeking a correct remedy for an individual, not only were Hahnemann's instructions amazingly wonderful and as complete as possible, really, without prejudicing his own case, without becoming non-inductive, but that line from the I Ching, or the Tao Te Ching, rather, the way that can be known is not the way. Any prospective paradigm of how to find the needed remedy is wrong, by definition, because it creates a deductive filter. The way that can be known is not the way.
Great, I love it.
And I think that really summarizes the inductive approach. We need to be flexible, you know? It can be equally characteristic of a case that this person is phenomenally chilly, equally characteristic as a mental symptom.
Sure.
We have to go where the case leads us. One of the great qualities of a homeopath needs to be his ability to be led, but not owned.
Sure. Well, you know, this is very interesting. You mentioned about a little bit about the mental symptomology, and certainly today there is this very big emphasis on mental-emotional symptoms, primary delusion, and this type of information. And I was wondering, I don't know if you've thought about this, Joe, but I know that Hahnemann, in his original provings, did the plants in Mother Tincture and the metals in a 1X trituration. I know that Hale, again, also did a lot of his provings with very low potencies. And I know that looking at contemporary provings, they're mostly generating mental-emotional symptoms. And I'm wondering if it's just the nature of the provings that we're doing that is determining the way that people actually practice. Since the new remedies largely only have mental-emotional symptoms, that's largely what people are focusing on because that's essentially what they have to work with. I don't know if you've thought about that or if you have any ideas or any thoughts on the whole thing.
I think a lot of the students who have been taught enter, again, with presuppositions. Presuppositions around central delusions, around themes, around essences, and their thinking, I believe, is skewed in that direction. A lot of very good physical symptoms were still derived with provings in the 30s and even the 200s. But I don't see a lot of highly characteristic modalities and physical symptoms in today's provings. Is that a consequence of how we are? I don't believe so. I think it's a consequence of what we believe we're going to find. I'm very suspicious of many modern provings. Yes, I'm an old fuddy-duddy, okay? So give me that. But I like to look at... Now, Hahnemann wouldn't release provings until they had a great number of characteristic physical modalities, sensations, enough to characterize the remedy with mathematical precision. Boininghausen himself, in his repertory, didn't have a huge section on the mental symptoms because he believed, well, A, it's difficult for beginners to pin it down. But when you try to, with too great a degree of finesse, identify a mental symptom and characterize the whole remedy through that, it's so difficult. And it's so subject to error. Whereas with physical symptoms, you can get a great array of great finesse in physical symptomatology and be extremely certain of what you have. You know, Dr. Sarabhai. Pardon?
I'm sorry, were you finished? I'm sorry.
But the only last thing I wanted to say about that was Dr. Sarabhai, in Homeopathic Reminiscences, a great homeopath, said, I far prefer to use physical symptoms where possible. I find I don't know my own mind, let alone someone else's.
Just taking that point a little bit further, I know there's quite a bit of emphasis these days on sensations. There's one school of homeopathy in particular that is really focusing on the importance and value of sensations. I know that's one of, you know, the qualities that Boininghausen was looking at when he described his Latin hexameter. But it seems to me, at least, and I'd like to hear your point of view on it, but it seems to me, at least, that of those Latin those items from Bunninghausen, the modalities, the location, the concomitant, that really the sensation is probably the least reliable, in that the way somebody describes one sensation versus another way another person describes it can be completely different. The language can be different, the vernacular, so on and so forth. So I was curious what you thought about that.
Oh, Kim, you are so, so right. You know, for example, the more a person, I find in my own practice, the more there are multiple mental, emotional symptoms in a case, the more there are anxieties, hysterias, the more, especially if the sensations are on the mental, emotional level, the less I will rely on them. The more definite, the more definite the sensation and clearly related to physical symptomatology, even then I will really be careful with it. For example, you and I were talking the other day about I was going insane trying to understand what a drawing pain was. Now, in a drawing pain to me, after some investigation, had always been a pulling, a tightness, as in a bowstring. And yet, on studying a Bunninghausen repertory and looking up the meaning of drawing and tearing, both coming from the German Rassen, were taken to mean exactly the same thing, and yet in Kent's repertory we have drawing and tearing, usually quite separately, and to me they seem to be quite different. Yeah. Now, in this particular version of the Bunninghausen repertory, we had drawing, meaning tearing or pulling, and we had different degrees of tearing. One would be simply as if it would be torn, one as if it had already been torn, and one as if it had been torn away from a particular point. Now, how do you DD that? It can be extremely difficult. So we must be very careful. Very careful. Modalities are by far and away much more reliable. And whenever we have the opportunity, we must anchor our case on things which are both characteristic and reliable.
Very, very good. Getting back to the aphorism 153.
Oh, yeah, where were we?
Just a little bit further on, Hahnemann uses the word striking, exceptional, unusual, odd, and then he puts in parentheses characteristic signs and symptoms. I was curious if you could just, you know, because he uses, I obviously, you know, it's been my experience that Hahnemann is never arbitrary. If he chose all those words, he wanted all those words to be in there. So I thought perhaps we could go through them individually and you could, you know, relate to us the importance of each of these words. I was also curious if you could put these words in relationship or context with the idea of keynotes, which I know was coined a little bit later, but you know, do you see the characteristic symptoms as being similar to keynotes, or what is the relationship between those various terms?
Great question. So let's go through the words first.
Okay.
All right. So we talk about just for those people who may have lost the flow of things, we're now talking about the more striking, exceptional, unusual and odd, or in brackets, characteristic signs and symptoms. Okay, this is the crux of homeopathy in terms of selection. And really, you know, it, as we'll see later if we get a chance to discuss it, it's really no different than modern information theory and linguistics. And it just speaks to the universality of Hahnemann's thinking. But let's go over these words. Striking. So what's something that's striking? How does that strike you, Kim?
Striking? Yeah, it's something that I pay attention to.
Well, exactly. Something that's striking forcibly apprehends your attention.
Mm-hmm.
So it speaks to an aesthetic sense. This, the word striking speaks to how the symptom picture grabs your aesthetic sense. Now, Hahnemann in the Medical Observer says we should be practicing nature drawing in order to learn how to draw an exact image. I'll take it one step further. You know, I think we should be studying art appreciation in order to see how different artists manipulate images so as to draw your attention from one image or color or figure, foreground to background, in their picture, because that has a great deal to do with the composition, the feel, the impression that that gives you. This all has to do with the word striking. The aesthetic appeal, that which grabs your attention, and how the symptom pattern manipulates your attention. This speaks to the aesthetic sense in the portrait of disease. Okay. Exceptional. What do you think there?
Well, something that's out of the ordinary, that's special, that's an exception to the rule.
Yes. So something exceptional, the word exceptional, implies, again, that you have a grasp. It's an intellectual apprehension here. Because when something is exceptional, there is a presupposition here that you know what is not exceptional, that you know what is usual. So what you're looking for is something in this case of influenza, which is exceptional, which goes against the grain, which stands out, which is unique, relative to the foreground background of a case of influenza. What is exceptional in this case of influenza? So we're looking for a foreground to the background in exceptional. Unusual can speak to the same thing, or it can also speak to something which is unusual or rarely found in itself. Well, what about the word odd or characteristic? What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting because I don't normally think of something that's characteristic necessarily being odd. It could or could not be odd, but just because it's characteristic doesn't, I mean, in my understanding, odd, it has a judgment, a little bit of a judgment associated with it. In other words, it's strange or not quite normal, whereas characteristic is just, it just differentiates that thing from other things.
Exactly. So the character, for example, the word characteristic is actually originally in the Greek. The word from which that was derived came from the idea of minting a coin and having a unique stamp on it so as to identify its denomination. That was its character. Another root of the word character comes from the concept of the pointed stick, something, I guess, which can distinctively and uniquely point specifically to something. So the concept of characteristic is that we have a feature here that separates this thing from all others. So it's, yes, putting it into a category of its own. Again, foreground, background, but this time not an aesthetic sense, not necessarily against what is usual or versus unusual, but here anything which can pointedly identify this individual case of disease or this remedy, the idea of characteristic. Then, of course, signs and symptoms means that we don't just take what the patient says, but also the signs from physical examination. Okay. These, above all, must correspond to very similar ones in the symptom set of the medicine sought, if it is to be the one most fitting, the most fitting one for cure. Now, again, a restatement of the law of similars. Now, what about this? The more common and indeterminate symptoms, then the brackets with those things, are to be seen with almost every disease and thus deserve little attention unless they are more closely characterized. What does that do for you?
Before we do that, could I just ask you one quick question?
Of course.
Because I just wanted to, you know, the object of all of this is the disease case, which I just think it's an interesting point to discuss, because most people, if you ask them the more striking, strange characteristics, signs, symptoms of the, and you just left it like that, most people would say patient.
And you're right. I left it out.
Yeah, and there's an assumption there that we're really treating the symptoms of the patient. So I thought maybe you could just maybe explain why Hahnemann specifically is talking about the disease here.
Oh, Kim, thank you for pointing that out to me. I forgot it. The disease case, yes. In homeopathy, we are not just prima facie treating the whole person. Very, very much in particular, we are treating the disease. The question is, what is the homeopathic definition of disease? And the homeopathic definition of disease is everything about that particular individual that is altered since the earliest perceptible departure from health. Now remember, this person is allowed to be whatever they are. If a person is not enlightened, it doesn't mean we have to take every single minor, totally normal, minorly neurotic symptom of this individual into account. When we include things in the totality of symptoms, Hahnemann tells us at the very beginning, I believe somewhere around aphorism 3, that we are to use those things which are undoubtedly diseased. And remember the time frame we're talking about. He wants us to use only things which are symptoms, which are true symptoms, that is, undoubtedly diseased, clear departures from the patient's norm. Which means if the person was some kind of creep, selfish creep, prior to his illness, it's whatever change from that that we're looking for. And in fact, the goal, if the person was a selfish, horrible human being prior to the onset of an illness, and then in his illness becomes some altruistic saint-like creature who is close to death, part of the cure would be returning him to his former state of health. Now that goes against the grain, because a lot of us feel that we should be moving a person towards enlightenment. That's not homeopathy.
Love it. Okay, so I'm sorry, we were talking about the last sentence, and specifically what Hahnemann is talking about here, and I guess what Bunninghausen addressed so nicely with his Latin hexameter, is really qualifying these kind of generalized or vague symptoms by, you know, adding modalities or concomitants or locations and somehow trying to qualify them. Is that what you were looking for?
Essentially, yes. But, you know, it's really wonderful when he says indeterminate symptoms. Mm. When he says indeterminate symptoms, because they are not more closely characterized. Mm. Oh, suddenly, closely characterized, to me that might imply, oh my goodness, by part of characterization, by a huge part of characterization, he's implying modalities.
Right.
And of course, this is the Bunninghausen method, and that's probably where he got it. The other thing here is we have to keep in mind, what is the function of 153? What is the function of this aphorism? It's to tell us, hey, we got to find a medicine. How are we going to find a medicine? We're going to find a medicine by hook or by crook, using the symptoms that are there, that we've chiseled out carefully, and we know, yes, it's there. But we're going to use anything about it that will narrow down our selection of remedies. We don't want indeterminate symptoms. We want determinant symptoms. Symptoms which will narrow down our search. And that's the whole point here. And that's why we get everything. Because we're looking for those rock, solid, reliable stepping stones that will lead us to a proving that bears the stamp of our case of disease in front of us.
Let me ask you, do you feel, Joe, that it's that for one of these, for a symptom to be basically a 153 aphorism symptom, that it has to be strange, rare, and peculiar, or can it be a symptom which just generally repeats itself, and you see it as kind of an idea that runs through the case, like, you know, heat, that runs through the case, and therefore characterizes that patient that they're hot, but even though it's not necessarily strange, rare, and peculiar, we would still consider it a 153 symptom, or how do you see that?
Because that particular symptom runs through the case, it is a genius symptom of the case, and we require that it be a genius symptom of our remedy, that it run through the remedy, hopefully to an equally great extent. Yes, and as a matter of fact, that's probably the highest level of generalization that was originally allowed in homeopathy. Bunninghausen took that as a high level of generalization, and also He then sought, he realized that by generalizing, he was going out on a limb. And he then did not give it one of his highest grades in his repertory until he had clinically verified it time and time again. That yes, you could do that. He was extraordinarily meticulous. You know, which leads us to a very important point in homeopathy. You know, homeopathy, if we look at homeopathy in terms of linguistics or experience, homeopathy is based predominantly on first order experiences, i.e. approving. Approving is a direct communication and observation of an altered feeling or function, an altered experience, but in a direct expression, sensory-based terminology, as rich in adjectives as can be accurately used. Then we have the next level of generalizations, which are when we peruse the proving, we might see that certain sensations or facts run through the proving. That's a second-order generalization. That's about all we can allow, because with each order of generalization above that, when we reflect back on the second order and say, well, gee, there's a lot of heat in the midst of these symptoms. Heat. Oh, you know, well, if it's hot, maybe that means there's a lot of passion that can be interpreted from this. Oh, that's a third order of interpretation or generalization. But as we go from one level to the next and up, the room for error, in fact, the obligatory error, increases exponentially. In homeopathy, Hahnemann realized this, and he told us, he said, only the pure language of experience. That is, most focus on the proving, on good, thorough provings. And don't escape to higher order generalizations, because then you're leaving induction, and there is no turning back, and there is no end.
So Joe, just practically, you've got, you know, you're looking for these strange, rare, and peculiar symptoms in your case. And maybe you could just give us some guidelines for how to find which ones really are the characterizing, exceptional, striking symptoms. You know, like, you know, relative to maybe the symptoms of the pathology, or, you know, the intensity of the symptom, if that has effect. What are we looking for? How are we going to decide which ones are going to fit this category and which ones are not going to fit the category?
We have a large spectrum of criteria for the word characteristic. We can use any one of them. You know, for example, in Dimitriadis's The Boininghausen Method, he talks about the definition of characteristic, the characteristic aspect of a symptom, being the one that is most often there. That is the one that is there most of the time, which might very well be a common symptom of a disease. So he says, no, it doesn't matter if it's a common symptom of a disease. What matters is we emphasize what is most often there in the way of an altered sensation or function with a modality, if we can get it. However, if given a choice between many of these symptoms, then suddenly we need to know foreground, background. We need to know, okay, we have a case of MS. And in a case of MS, numbness and tingling, well, that's not going to get you very far. Because so suddenly we must know pathology. We must know the natural history of what is very frequent in illness so as not to use it as a principal basis for prescription unless there's something dramatically striking about it. For example, numbness and tingling might be very common in MS, but if the numbness and tingling is so dramatic so as to make the patient go insane with the tingling, suddenly, by the intensity, it elevates itself in your attention. It strikes you. So we need to know the natural history, not simply to exclude what is common, but to judge, always using judgment, what is it here that strikes us, what is peculiar, what is characteristic. Anyone who says that diagnosis and pathology are unimportant has no basis for judgment. Not in the homeopathic sense. Now remember, I'm defining homeopathy as a particular system of medicine as defined by Hahnemann. If we choose to redefine it, we shouldn't call it homeopathy.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You know, Joe, I want to just, I see that we're running out of time here, and I want to give everyone else an opportunity to ask some questions. I'd like to just, before we do that, though, if you could, I know that people listening to you, again, I want to reiterate that, you know, this is really the tip of the iceberg with Dr. Kellerstein. If you go and you study with him, you'll see somebody who's a real master practitioner who gets consistently high results, and not only that, is able to effectively teach his students to do the same thing that he's doing. And I think really that's really the key. If we want a homeopathy to grow around the world, we're going to have to create a lot of very competent practitioners who are getting, you know, 85, 90, 95% success in their practice. I think that's the future for us to make homeopathy successful. So, Joe, perhaps some people might be interested in studying with you, or where could they get more information? Are there any projects you're working on? What can you tell us is going on right now with you?
Well, what's going on right now, Kim, is this. I operate a two-year course for homeopaths, for people with some prior instruction in homeopathy, and it consists of 7 two-day weekends over the course of a year and then 2 years. The focus of the course is making homeopathy a practical reality. So we study in-depth questioning technique. We study in-depth, very broad case-taking technique. We study the materia medica of the polycrests and some of the lesser-known remedies. But then we very intensively do organon, and the jewel of the course to me is that together, in order to get a sense of how to create the genius or the totality of a case, we go through cases from the old literature and try to combine all of our knowledge on all subjects in order to successfully solve very tiny, bite-sized cases, case after case after case, to reinforce repertory, which we study extensively in combination with case-taking, to reinforce our knowledge of medicine, to reinforce our knowledge of materia medica, and to get a very good sense of how to create that gut-pleasing feeling that constitutes knowing the genius of the case. Now, hopefully this year, for people who can't make it to Toronto.
So can you give them contact information if they do want to come to Toronto, how they can reach you?
Sure. You can either call me at my office at 905-433-8666. We have a website called homeopathybythebook.com, all one word. That's our contact info.
Okay, good.
And hopefully this coming year we'll be able to put some of the entire course, I hope, including the case books that I've put together, hopefully we'll be able to record our lectures and get it on the road that way. At least that's the plan right now.
Oh, that would be fantastic. I know that people who, you know, for whatever reason can't go up to Toronto would love to be able to study with you at home. And you'll let us know. Hopefully we can do another call soon and you'll let us know more about the plans with regards to that.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to.
All right, Joe, thank you again. Really, these calls, I mean, I feel like we could just go on forever talking about it, but I see the time is running out, so I'm going to open it up to the audience and let them ask some questions. So just hold on, and thank you again.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Kim.
Hi, everybody.
Joe.
Hello.
Go ahead. Somebody have a question?
Yes. I just want to tell one thing. That really, that is very interesting, that my husband, who was suffering from influenza for whole 1 week, and the one symptom which he said that the temperature was not coming down, and only it will come at about 4 p.m. every day. And I said, tell me what actually exactly you are feeling. And he said, if anybody touches me, suppose you just touch me with your finger, and I will fall. That is the feeling. He discussed. I said, why didn't you tell me earlier? And I gave him gelsenium and one dose, imagine, no temperature after that. So the one feeling was that as you touch me, I'll fall. And that is what I felt so interesting, that feeling of that paralyzing feeling.
Mm.
And another thing I'm just telling, that what you said, is it the delusion we can take as well? Delusion. Sometimes somebody is so deluded, like a fear of, like somebody has got, anything happens to the body, and they are afraid of something very, very, like, worst will going to happen. Is it a delusion? Delusion state? And can we take that as the specificity?
So did you get the question?
I did.
Delusion.
Yes. Now, first of all, to call it a delusional state would be premature without having more diagnostic information about the entire nature of the case. And if it were a delusional state, the delusions generally are not all that valuable in determining the uniqueness of a particular case from a Hahnemanian perspective. The fear of something happening is a fairly large rubric, although, yes, we would want one of those remedies. So fear of impending illness, fear something is about to happen, fear of disease, but then that necessitates a closer inspection of that particular fear. I would call that the way you presented it. I would look upon it originally as, oh, fear. Then I would say, okay, fear of what? And I would try to investigate more thoroughly. But I don't see any necessary evidence there yet to support delusional state. And if it were a delusional state, remember, the greater the number of fears, the less the value of any one of them in determining the remedy.
Joe, in general, though, sometimes in your practice, if somebody does have a clear delusion and you can identify it as such, will you use it as part of your remedy picture?
What I'll do is I will certainly use it as part of my remedy picture. However, I may not necessarily use it as an anchor, as a guiding symptom to the case. I'll keep it in mind, and I'll say there's a wonderful Edward de Bono, who wrote many books on thinking, said when you don't want to put too much weight on something, just put the word Poe before it in your mind, meaning perhaps, maybe, you know, so you don't lean on it. So I would say, okay, could this be hyoscyamus or one of the remedies in there? If it were hyoscyamus, how does that stack up against the totality of characteristic symptoms in this case I am using to guide me to a remedy? So I would consider it, but I would not arbitrarily go for it as a sole guiding principle.
Okay, fair enough. Hold on a second. I'm going to bring somebody else on. Somebody else would like to ask a question.
Hi, this is Barbara, and I was wondering, Joseph, about Kim's question in terms of comparing characteristics with keynotes, because I know, you know, people have gone off down the garden path just taking a keynote and then prescribing on that instead of taking the totality of the characteristic symptoms, and I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Oh, sure, that's a great question. Guernsey had the same trouble, didn't he, Kim? So Guernsey, when he invented the keynote system, was accused right, left, and center of simply using a single symptom upon which to prescribe. But years later, after he wrote his original article on the keynote symptom, he had to write a second article to defend himself, where the whole first article explained it perfectly to begin with, but he developed this horribly bad rap with the idea of keynotes. Really, there is no difference between the keynote system and Hahnemann's methodology in selecting the most characteristic or peculiar symptom. He's just using the most striking aspects of remedies, calling them keynotes, much as you would hear the chorus of something, and you would say, oh, I can name that tune. But Guernsey never said, when he devised the keynote system, he never said, just name that tune and do it. Absolutely, no. He said, first, see, does it correspond to the remainder of the case in an appropriate manner. But there's no difference between that and Hahnemann's 153. You're looking for things that will narrow your selection. The proper application of the keynote system is as I have just described. The keynote leads you to a small group of remedies. You then say to yourself, could it be this remedy? Let's look and see if we can disprove it with the remaining groups of symptoms or ideas of this remedy. So the bad rap of the keynote system is simply a misunderstanding of the original work of Guernsey. And you know, we have to mine those original journals of ours to such a great extent so we don't keep repeating the same mistakes generation after generation, which is why Kim, your product and EH with those old journals is absolute magic. I love it.
I know. I love it, too. What a wealth of information is contained in there, really.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable. For those of you who don't know, he's talking about the Radar homeopathic software, Encyclopedia Homeopathica has in some of the larger packages incorporated most of the really good old Hahnemannian journals, and these are just an amazing resource of cases and discussions and philosophy, and it's quite rich. You know, Joe, for me, one of the things that I think is very important about Aphorism 153 that is difficult, especially for students, is the issue of finding the characteristic or maybe even keynote symptom in the case first. In other words, finding what is characteristic in the case and then matching that to the corresponding set of symptoms in the available list of medicines, as opposed to just reading through your case, like, oh, here's a keynote of sepia, oh, here's a keynote of natmir, oh, here's a keynote of silica, which I think creates a lot of confusion, as most of our cases seem to have keynotes of many different remedies. Can you comment a little on that? Or?
You bet. So first, when we look at a case, we need to be able to segregate the case. We need to say, these are the symptoms of the person. These are the symptoms that relate more predominantly to syndrome A, say the rheumatoid arthritis, B, say the asthma. And then with each of that as background, we then say, okay, here are the symptoms of the rheumatoid arthritis. What is especially striking and characteristic about them? Does it correspond to a particular remedy? Then we do the same with the other parts of the case. We say then, is this one remedy? Is this more than one remedy? All of this requires, A, methodology, B, it requires close instruction with somebody who is experienced, and then C, it requires effort. Effort in the sense of being willing to get out there and practice the technique of saying, well, these are the common symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. This is how this might be exceptional, unusual, or characteristic. This is that of the patient. This is very unusual here. And then you need a teacher. Homeopathy requires mentoring. That's why I invite students into my practice to see, do I practice what I preach? Do we get results? And I want to show them. It's really nothing special. It's only the application of what we can perceive in the organon. But it does require practice. It does require mentoring. Homeopathy is, after all, the medicine of experience in many different ways.
Very true. Okay, I think we have time left for one question. So one final question. Hold on. One last question for Dr. Joe Kellerstein.
This is Catherine.
Hi, Catherine.
This is really interesting, and I'm considering studying homeopathy and wondering if you teach pathology in your course.
No, we don't. In my course, most of the people who take the course are people who have had some degree of instruction in homeopathy or some other medical background, for example, naturopathy or medicine, already. We don't have the wherewithal to instruct in pathology. I particularly just want to focus on studying homeopathy.
Joe, thank you very much for that. And I just wanted to give a quick answer to the lady. I know that Whole Health Now is actually going to be coming out with a DVD set that teaches anatomy, pathology, and physiology.
Wow.
Those are going to be put together by Dr. Will Taylor, and that is going to be a program that's going to be available probably sometime at the end of the summer. And I think that's going to probably be, for homeopaths at least, the best resource we have if you specifically want to study anatomy, physiology, and pathology, since he's going to be largely doing it from a homeopathic point of view. So, yeah, I just wanted to add that in. And, Joe, could you reiterate again just your contact information in case people want to reach you, get more information, learn how they can study with you?
You bet. The website is homeopathybythebook.com. My office number is 905-433-8666.
Fantastic. Well, Joe, thank you again so much for another wonderful call. Let me unmute and let everybody thank you personally. Everyone give Joe a big thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It was awesome.
Joe, take care. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Kim. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.